following program, entitled The Big S, A Day in the Life of Richard, was supported by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland under the Sound and Vision Scheme. This program speaks to Richard McGee, who suffers from a mild form of schizophrenia. Schizophrenia is defined as a mental disorder. The signs and symptoms vary from individual to individual, but all people with the disorder show one or more of the following symptoms: delusions, hallucinations, bizarre behaviour, disorganised speech, or negative symptoms.
I'm a sufferer of mild schizophrenia. I'm basically over the worst of it, but I have been left in life with the kind of the remnants of the illness, not any symptoms of the disease, but just the fact that I'm not employed or I'm not married the way people who were in my school and college with me are. Your life takes a different turn. I'm not living a stereotypical life, but I'm coping with my life. I'm doing my best, and I'm trying to campaign in a small way that I can to help sufferers of schizophrenia, particularly to have a better life. There's a lot of stuff about depression on the news, and there's a lot of stuff about people who suffer with depression and anxiety, but schizophrenia is largely overlooked because the word terrifies people. It kind of encompasses a fear of violent people and dangerous people. And we have to. I'm just here to try and make the point that ordinary sufferers of schizophrenia are not dangerous at all. As Terry Lynch said in his book Beyond Prozac, people with ordinary schizophrenia are more afraid of you than you are of them. And we're not dangerous, but it's not known. As I said, ordinary schizophrenics are not dangerous. They just find life stressful. You go into your own little world to a degree when you have the illness. When you're psychotic, you can't concentrate on things, you can't focus. Socializing is extremely stressful, and you just have to take your meds and get back to that normal place in life. You do come around to a large degree. You don't get your health back quite as well as a well person, but if you take your meds and look after yourself, you can get back to 90%, and that's as good as you can hope for. Hopefully there will be better medications at some stage, but at the moment we're lucky to have the meds we have. Psychosis is difficult because you can't argue logically, and your thinking is coloured by your delusions, and you need to be brought into a healthier place with medication. And sometimes when the doctors take you in to hospital first, you can't. There's no point in them talking to you in a big way because you're so psychotic that you may not be making sense, and they'll rationalise with you if you're well enough. But if you're very psychotic, they just have to medicate you for 6 to 8 weeks. And luckily, within 6 to 8 weeks, it's great. Most psychosis can be brought under control within 6 to 8 weeks, as long as you're not drinking or taking drugs or anything like that. And but in the throes of deep psychosis, the only answer is to medicate the person, and then you'll get sense out of them after a few weeks. My earliest memories were growing up in Hainault Road in Foxrock. We were very lucky. My father married late in life, but he was a very, very kind, caring man. And my mother was very devoted to us. There was Philip and I, and then we lost a little girl, and then there was Ken. But we were very well looked after. We had a lovely house on Hainault Road. It was the second one in the estate. And we used to play across the road. It was an area now called The Thicket in Foxrock, but we used to play across the road. There was a big open, like a hinterland, where we used to play, and it used to stretch over to Brighton Road, and we were so lucky, and we'd play there. But we used to always wonder why we'd be out playing, and at about 9 o'clock, Dad would come over and say, time for bed. But this would be in the middle of the summer, and we thought the days never ended in the summer, and nor did the holidays. I was sent to the local national school, St. Bridget's, with my brother Philip, but my father had difficulties with his health when I was about 8, and so... we were sent to boarding school, which was grand, but my brother found boarding school a bit stressful, and we were sent down to Naas, to a little convent outside Naas, and it's now a hotel, and it was grand. I didn't mind it, but the nuns were very tough. They were strict, and they used to clatter us, so you learned to toughen up, but it was a discipline. And even though we had many's a laugh, which we did, and even though it was tough, it made us like young. By the time we were 12, it made us like young lads, like more like 14-year-olds than 12-year-olds. I want to tear down the walls and hold me aside. And then from there I switched to Clongowes Wood College in Naas in County Kildare. And that was a lovely school, but I began to have problems with my illness at about the age of 14. And there was a lot of slagging in the school, and enjoyed it, but there was a lot of slagging, and it was only a bit of crack. But when I got sick, I was so sensitive, I thought it was all serious, and I couldn't process it properly. And I begged my father to take me out after second year, and that were my first signs of mild psychosis at 14. And then I came home after the inter because the priest said to my father that I was a bit insecure and that I wasn't coping well. And it was the early signs of my illness.
Richard's mother lost her husband when Richard himself was in his late teens. For the last 30 odd years, she has stood by Richard as he has battled with mild schizophrenia.
It all began when we went on a holiday to America in 1980. Richard was a boarder at the time, and as far as we knew, he was happy there and he was getting on okay. That's what we thought. And he was left in charge of his aunt, who was supposed to see that he went back to boarding school with the group. But instead of that, Richard ran away, and he was found in a field in RD by the police. And they couldn't understand what he was doing there. And he told them he was trying to get to his relations in Clonus. So the police took him in and contacted the relations and brought him up to Clonus. Now, we were in San Francisco. We knew nothing about this, but it caused a lot of stress and worry for my sister-in-law. That was the start of Richard's problems. We couldn't get to grips with it, but then it turned out that there was a lot of bullying going on in the school, and Richard by nature is very sensitive and he just couldn't hack it. But if he told us that he was very unhappy there and didn't want to go back, we would have done something. So we arrived back from America two weeks later. He had stayed up in Clonus with the relations. He seemed to be okay, but he wasn't looking forward going back. And with hindsight, I think we should never have sent him to a boarding school. If I had my life over again, I'd do it differently. Anyway, that was the beginning of his problems.
And then I went to a school in Ranelagh, a very good school. And that was great. The lads were great fun. But again, I was okay till I was 17. Then I had more kind of insecurity. But you see, I would never pretend about any psychotic symptoms till I was 21. So it was very hard for the doctors to understand. I had been with a doctor when I was 14. And he sat me down and he said to me, he asked me all these questions and he smoked a pipe and he couldn't see anything wrong. And then I was sent to the South Dublin County Services when I was a bit older and they couldn't see anything wrong. So I was 21 before I was given any medication. But when I'm in good form and when things are going well, I'm a character. I have the crack and I love having the slagging and the banter. It's just that when you're ill or when you're in the middle of a kind of a confusion of that you're not sure whether it's a psychosis or not, it's hard to be spontaneous, which I couldn't be for a long time. So I just decided that when I got to 21, I went on a J1. I was in Carlow RTC studying business studies, and I went to America, and I knew then I was ill in America, and my mother begged me not to go, but I went, and I survived for 20 weeks with an antidepressant from a GP, a Dr. John Eric Jacoby, a lovely man over there, gave me an antidepressant, and he looked after me. He knew there was something seriously wrong with me, but he didn't tell me. And I think, Ger, the reason I survived was I didn't know what was wrong with me, so I just had to keep going. And then when I came home that winter, I thought, well, I'm going to London with the lads now. But I'd failed all my exams, and I was sent down to the Black Rock service, and I was immediately put into hospital. And from there, the story unfolds.
Dr. Baker phoned me in the morning, left a note, he's still yawning. Dr. Baker phoned me in the morning, left a note, she couldn't make it. How did she ever take a lesson outside his head?
We go back to Richard McGee's mother, who continues the narration of Richard's life story. Richard went to Sanford School, and then he did his leaving cert.
He did his leaving cert. He passed it not very well, not as well as we'd hoped, but he did his best because he wasn't well at the time. And then he went on to the regional college in Carlo, and he was doing a course there, and that's where he really became ill. And he wrote to his doctor asking him, he'd been seeing a psychiatrist, they never got the letter, he was never shown the letter. And Richard went on a J1 to America, and I really thought I would lose my life because he wasn't well going, and I knew he wasn't well, but I couldn't restrain him.
And it's ironic, you think, when you're away, and I coped when I was away in America, even though I was very ill, I coped. And then they take you into hospital and you become kind of helpless because they tell you what's wrong with you. And then you're in there for 5 or 6 weeks and you start, you've got to, can't cope with anything. But you actually, as the doctor said to me at the time, you actually do get worse for about a year or two before you start to mend. Because I think once they start to pile on the antipsychotics, the disease comes to the fore. And even though I felt worse, I was actually getting better, and I was out of hospital in 8 weeks. And then I tried various courses, but I would try to go to the rehab over in Sandyman, but I wasn't well enough and I had to leave. And so I went to Taney Motors rehab garage in Goatstown, which is gone now, and I worked there for a year and a half, and it was therapeutic, and I began to get a little bit of my health back. I had a nagging delusion which really gave me an awful time for a long time, but it was a ridiculous delusion. I took a couple of pulls of a joint and I thought I had harmed my brain, and the doctors kept telling me you didn't take enough to do any harm, that your system broke it down. But I was convinced I'd harmed my brain, so this scared the life out of me. But it would come and go, and when it used to leave me during the day, I'd enjoy the couple of hours I got off from it and have a bit of banter, and then it'd come back. But that was the nature of the disease, and the doctors did their damnedest for me. And luckily, after about 8 or 9 years on medication, olanzapine came on the fore, Zyprexa, and I was put on that, and I improved hugely on that because the older drugs weren't as effective. I was on Melril and an antidepressant called Tofranil, imipramine, and an injection, Dipixol, and the Dipixol helped me, but the real improvement came when I was put on olanzapine in 1997, because before that I had the odd panic attack and stress. I couldn't deal with much pressure. People don't understand. Well, people just don't understand the disease. They're very kind when they try to understand, but they don't know what we endure, and they don't realise. So a lot of people wonder why you can't just snap out of it and be yourself and have the crack like everybody else. But unfortunately, Jerry, you can't, because it's a disease. You can't just be. I remember I went down one time to Eden Derry to a friend of mine down in the country, and his brother hadn't known anything about my illness, and I didn't want to go out that night because I found socialising so difficult. And he said to me, Eddie said to me, are you coming out? And I said, no, I don't want to go out, I'll just stay in. And his brother said, looked at Eddie and said, what's wrong with him? And schizophrenia, and people don't understand if they haven't been there. But I can tell you can't just pull out of it. If you could, every single person with schizophrenia and depression would jump to the fore, stop taking their meds and join you in the nightclub at the pub immediately. And there'd be nothing more they'd like more than to have nothing to do with tablets or having to. But it's a psychotic disease, and it's a brain disease of sorts, and it's a chemical imbalance in that sense, and you can't just pull out of it, you know.
Is friendship important to you, or are your worries, or is your condition the main worry you have, and you don't have time for friends.
No, I've loads of friends. I've about 60 of them in my 60 or 70 friends and my people. Now, I'm not in touch with them all regularly, but I'm in touch with them over a period of the year. I'd be in touch with them all. Friends mean an awful lot to me. And when I was trying clozapine in the hospital 4 years ago, 5 years ago, I just went in to try a drug to see, because they thought I could go back paying income tax, but it didn't have any effect on me. But the nurse said to me, the great thing with you is you have loads of friends, and friends mean so much to you, especially when you have if you have a couple of friends who are inverted commas ill, who have the illness, and then you have well friends. Sometimes you can get really good advice off your inverted commas well friends about a situation that the other lads mightn't be sure of. And I've always relied on my friends, and they're always there for me. Okay, a lot of the time I might over text them and over ring them because they're busy and they've got kids and they're married and they've jobs, and you might overdo. But they understand that I need them, and I've about 12 or 13 really close friends who jump through fire for me, and I'm very lucky, you know.
I ask Richard if everybody is susceptible to a mental health issue. And Richard goes on to speak about the role illegal drugs can play in the development of psychotic disorders.
Some people are more susceptible than others, but anyone could get it. You might get lads out there and you get it. You do get this in society, and we try and warn kids about it. You know the way you get 10 or 11 lads in an estate? It could be anywhere. It could be a working class estate. It could be an upper middle class. It could be a middle. It could be any estate. But there's so many drugs out there. You get 9 or 10 of them out and they're all smoking hash and drinking and taking ease and all that, and they think it's great. And probably 6 or 7 of them will get away with it completely and continue to have a great time, even though they're damaging themselves. But the other two of them will get the big S, schizophrenia, and won't go down with depression. And I know of a girl who worked with me years ago in Great Orcadian, who said to me, when her brother took too many drugs and got schizophrenia, he sat there saying, what the hell is wrong with me? And the amount of people who take their mental health for granted is unbelievable. You go into a nightclub, they're taking ease, hash, coke, crack, you name it, all these things, and they're getting away with it, and the sense of great buzz. But if you get schizophrenia, you'll know all about it. It's a horrible disease, and it's something that takes a long time to pull out of. And if you do get a psychotic episode, you'll soon realise that all your drug taking was not worth it. And as well as killing off a lot of brain cells, maybe with billions of those, so you can get away with that. But if you start to get a psychotic episode, you'll soon realise that drugs will be the bane of your existence, and really that it's a nightmare situation. And that's why some people with schizophrenia try and warn kids not to be taking drugs, and not, because it's not only the fact that they're bad for you physically and in terms of maybe damaging your body, they can also wreck your mental health, and that's a thing that's not considered enough in society.
Professor Paul Fearon, consultant psychiatrist at St. Patrick's University Hospital, Dublin, speaks of the possible causes of schizophrenia.
There are a lot of causes, if you like, for want of a better word, for schizophrenia. We know there are a lot of things that can potentially trigger it. Up until relatively recently, and by that I mean about maybe 10 years ago, the jury was out on cannabis. We know, for example, that people after they develop schizophrenia do smoke more cannabis than the general population, and it was thought that that might be due to helping them to relax or to deal with the symptoms that they had. But actually, better quality studies done more recently would tend to support strongly the idea that actually cannabis has a role in causing schizophrenia. We know that from a number of high quality studies. When you combine those studies together, it looks like overall, if you smoke cannabis, you're at about a 2-fold increased risk compared to someone who doesn't smoke cannabis. That risk is greater if you start cannabis at a younger age, below the age of 13, but it's still there all along, even if it's after that. Also, it's worth pointing out that the cannabis that's available now is a lot stronger. It's a lot more potent than the cannabis that was available maybe 10, 15 years ago. So I don't think the idea of cannabis being a nice, harmless, little friendly drug that it might have been in the 60s and 70s is no longer the case. Certainly, I've kept an open mind about this, but I do really believe that cannabis, for certain individuals, can be quite a dangerous drug, and it can provoke the onset of a psychotic illness.
Is medication in the treatment of schizophrenia nearly always a must?
How I'd answer that is to say that there's overwhelming evidence that for people who have schizophrenia, medication is an important part of the treatment. We know that the medications for schizophrenia, the so-called antipsychotics, they're very effective, particularly in getting in, helping to control the delusions and the voices. They reduce them by about 70%. They're very, very effective. Now, they're not the only treatment. So it's very important that people with schizophrenia aren't just given medication, that's it. It's very important they suffer a lot of challenges in their life. As I mentioned previously, they may have been having these symptoms for a few years, lost their friends, lost their job. So it's very important to build in a good care package or care plan, which involves not only medication, but also maybe rehabilitation, getting back to work, developing hobbies, developing a network of friends again if they've lost that. So all of these things really need to be looked at with anybody who presents to us with these psychotic symptoms or a diagnosis of schizophrenia.
I ask Richard's mother about early intervention and how it might have helped with Richard's condition. You said earlier on early intervention would have helped, and then I could say to you in those days probably we didn't know enough about.
Well, it's not that long ago. I mean, nowadays there's early intervention. We used to sit around with psychiatrists and doctors and people kind of peering at us, and we were supposed to be the cause of it, Richard's illness, but we knew deep down that there was something wrong with Richard and we were only trying to get him help.
Maybe all it was that he was a very nervous and sensitive person.
Yes, he was a very nervous person. He probably gets it from me. And there were boys there that used to bully you and slag you. I suppose most people would take it in their stride, but Richard didn't. And then to be called Panic Man, he was known as Panic Man. And then his younger brother, when we went down to visit, was known as Panic Junior, which wasn't very nice. So I don't have happy memories. But I think that really, with hindsight, day school is better.
Dr. Fearon comments on the possibility that childhood trauma might be a possible trigger of psychotic episodes.
We know generally that there's increasing evidence that there's what we call an association between early childhood adversity or trauma and the later development of schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders. Now, the question is still not quite answered, although we're getting there, as to whether people who are destined to develop schizophrenia might be more sensitive or shy and therefore might be exposed to more trauma in childhood. In other words, it's not the trauma that causes the schizophrenia, but it's the antecedents, if you like, of schizophrenia that might expose somebody to more trauma. But there is increasing evidence. For example, Mary Cannon, Ian Kelleher and their colleagues in Dublin have recently published a really high quality paper in the American Journal of Psychiatry looking at over 1,000 adolescents between the age of 13 and 16. And they found a direct effect of childhood bullying and the onset of psychotic symptoms. What they also found was that if that childhood trauma was taken away, that the symptoms were reversed somewhat. But that's only one part of a very big picture. To say that bullying itself or childhood trauma itself is alone is enough to develop schizophrenia, we just don't know. We know that genetics play a very major role in the development of schizophrenia and an awful lot of other things as well. So it's not just simply that.
I'm assuming that you have got used to Richard and his condition.
Oh, yes. I mean, I don't think of him now as he's much, much better now, but it's taken the guts of 25 years and he's lost out on a lot of things in life that all his friends have, and it's kind of sad. But he accepts his situation. It isn't easy, and it's even worse in a recession because nobody wants to know you if you've had a breakdown. But Richard battles on, and he's written a book about his illness, and he's hoping to He's had one small pamphlet published and he's hoping to write another. But people don't understand at all about mental illness. They think you're going to stick a knife in them or something. It isn't like that. I mean, in extreme cases, it might be. But there's a lot of other people mentally ill who need to be diagnosed early intervention. That's the whole answer.
And the other thing that is known is a lot of people with schizophrenia and depression have great personalities, but unfortunately their illness has smothered their personality. And before I got sick, I was at the party animal down in Carlow having a great time. Nobody understood when suddenly I didn't find things funny anymore. And it was only because I was psychotic and I didn't know what was wrong. I was slipping into this psychosis. And my mother didn't realise it and my brothers didn't realise it. And my mother said, and I kept saying to myself, pull yourself together, you're having a great time, you're in college. But it was chemical, Ger. So I couldn't do anything about it, except the only thing I could do was access the services for medication. And I didn't get medication until I came home, proper medication, until I came home from America. And the illness had kicked in a big way at that stage. But to answer your question again, if somebody with schizophrenia or depression is having a good day, they'll interact as much as anyone else. And they're just as kind and as caring, sometimes more so because of the fact that they've suffered in their lives. You will see me lost high, see me lost inside. You will see me lost high, see me lost inside. You will see me lost high, see me lost inside. You will see me lost high.
Dr. Paul Fearon from St. Patrick's University Hospital. Richard says that he felt quite helpless when he was officially told he had schizophrenia. And he mentioned as well that he got worse before he got better. Can you follow? Can you explain what might have happened here?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of options. It's a very understandable reaction. First of all, you don't develop schizophrenia or any psychotic disorder overnight. It can often be getting a diagnosis can often be the end result of many months or even many years of distress. And actually getting a diagnosis, although it can be very useful in terms of treatment, etc., can actually focus your mind. So it can lead to a lot of thinking about yourself. And often getting a diagnosis implies receiving treatment, often medication and other treatments. And so by definition, when you get a diagnosis, often the focus in that initial stage after the getting the diagnosis involves an awful lot of focus on the illness. And that can be distressing oftentimes, and hopefully things settle down then because you may feel your symptoms, such as hearing voices or unusual thoughts that you've been having for some time, improve on treatment. And that can then lead to things getting better for you. But certainly in that initial stage, it can be quite stressful, both for the person themselves and friends and family. Yeah.
Richard talks about how he handles stress and pressure.
You do get better in time, and at this stage now it's under control. I can function, I can socialise, I can have the crack, I can do things with people, I can enjoy life. I don't take pressure as well people, but I can still enjoy life and I can still do things.
How do you mean, just to fill me in and the listener, pressure, even, for example, even meeting me today?
I know, that's not too bad, and you put me at my ease immediately. It's just say you were told to work in a pub for a night or something like that. Now, I could do it, but I wouldn't enjoy it, and I'd be so stressed that if the lads were all taking the wire at you at 1 o'clock in the morning, I'd laugh it off. But I'd probably laugh it off for about an hour, and then I'd say, God, this is really hard. They're all slagging. Whereas the ordinary barman, he'd say, listen, this is banter every night, you know. We're more sensitive, and if we have our guard up, we can take a good slagging. And I can take a slagging, but if it goes on for ages, I start to process and think, because our self-esteem is lower due to what happened to us, you start to say, I wonder do they mean that. Now, I'm getting over that, and I can take a good rip. And some of my mates give me a good slagging, but they're great characters.
Dr. Fearon speaks about delusions.
One of the core features of people with a psychotic disorder such as schizophrenia, and by psychotic, a broad definition of that is an illness where you either temporarily or for a period of time lose full contact with reality or have unusual experiences. A delusion is a false belief that you later find out when you're well isn't true. And people with schizophrenia commonly have delusions. They can persist for some time. They can last for some time. And even some people with schizophrenia, even if they're well controlled on medication and doing well in some ways, some people still have a delusion which may be less intense and less bothersome than it was, but it's still there. Obviously, as clinicians, we do our very best to eliminate these altogether, and the medications that are around now help us to do that with more effect. But some people, even when they recover from their false beliefs, and they can sometimes still believe that those things in the past still did happen, whatever they believed when they were unwell. And so even though they say, well, they're not happening now, but they definitely did happen in the time, we sometimes come across that. But it's important to emphasise that delusions, the definition is a fixed false belief. So it's not just something like a worry or even a strong worry. It's actually something that you believe 100%. Now, having said that, there are certain psychological therapies like cognitive behaviour therapy for psychosis, which is a branch of cognitive behaviour therapy for people who have very persistent delusions that aren't maybe fully controlled with medication, whereby the person working with the cognitive behaviour therapist may work on strategies to help distract themselves from these or to minimise them. But it's not just a question of simply mind over matter or talking yourself out of it. It's a bit more complex than that.
You've just finished a book at the moment called The Mood Swings.
The reason I've just finished writing the book called The Mood Swings is I knew three lads who were with me in the services in the late 1980s and early 1990s. They were sufferers, and they had their own difficulties in life, and one or two of them got mixed up with people who didn't care about them and had them taking street drugs. There were three gas characters, and they're all dead. They're no longer with us from suicide, and because of that I decided to write the book to tell society, to give people a laugh about their happiness, their happy times, their sad times, and tragically their end, their demise, because of schizophrenia and depression, and because they wanted to be like everybody else, but people didn't really give them a chance. Not the services. The services were brilliant to them, but one of the lads was a lovely guy, but he got involved in a job in a company, and he got in with lads who were smoking cannabis, which is lethal for mental health sufferers. It causes psychosis. He got in with a crowd smoking a lot of cannabis. He smoked it, and it led to his demise. He became totally psychotic and didn't recover. He was a lovely guy with a brilliant sense of humour. He wasn't just a human. He wasn't just a human being who suffered from schizophrenia. He was a brilliant mathematician. He was colourful. He was witty, and he was very, very loving. And any girl who ever knew him, and then a couple of girls I knew who went out with him, said he was one of the nicest people they ever met. And he's no longer with us, and it's about time society stopped and realised a lot of people with this illness are going to take their lives unless people try and help them integrate into society and give them a chance. Just in retrospect, to look back and to see that these people were real, genuine, and had happinesses, sorrows, joys and fears and feelings like anyone else, but because of their mental illness, they became overwhelmed, and the medication wasn't quite as effective as it is nowadays. People can live relatively normal lives now, but in those days the medication wasn't as good, and also they didn't make it because they didn't have the supports in place, not from the service, but maybe in family and stuff. They were loved, but their families didn't really understand them completely, and because of that, they didn't make it.
Prayer has been helpful to you.
Yes, I think these things are sent to you for a reason, these illnesses. And if you try and accept them and go along with God, in the end, hopefully things will come right.
My mother has always been wonderful to me. She's been very loving and understanding over the years. She's always tried to be there for me. She has prayed for me every day for the last 46 years of my life. Every day of my life, she has been a wonderful mother.
You're so right.
I have two very good brothers. They understand my condition, and they do their best for me. One of them has a few difficulties himself. The other fella's in Canada and he's married with kids. He's happy. He's doing well. But my family are very good to me overall. And it's very important. I need breaks from at times. It gets a bit stressful at times. But you wouldn't be without your family. And my father, who's long dead, was a wonderful man, even though I only had him till I was 18. The reason I've come through mental illness and coped so well and done so much is because I came from a very stable family background. A lot of people who don't come from stable family backgrounds with mental illness don't make it. And I made it because my family are fantastic.
You are listening to The Big S, Schizophrenia, A Day in the Life of Richard. This is a programme which explores how mild schizophrenia has affected the life of Richard for the past 30 years. We speak to Richard, some of his colleagues, his mother, and a range of experts who contribute to the betterment of Richard's life on a daily basis. This programme was supported by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland under the Sound and Vision Scheme. Myself and Richard's mother are now looking at some old photographs of Richard and his family. When was that taken, do you think, that photograph?
Well, we left Hainault in 1990, so it must have been taken before we left. I can't remember exactly. It would have been after his dad died anyway.
And how old was he there? How old was Richard in this picture?
I'd say he's about 19. 19, I mean, he was always young looking, you know. I don't think he's any more than 19. But, I mean, everything, you know, all the hopes we had were all kind of, you know, dashed. And when he became ill, and all his ideas of what he'd hoped to do and be, because Richard has plenty of intelligence. I mean,
Had he ever said to you when he was younger that he wanted to be something in particular, or did he ever express a particular dream to you?
No, because he was still at school, and I think he probably hadn't decided at that stage what he wanted to be, but he was striving to do as well as he could in the blooming exams that you have to pass. And then by the time he finished doing that, he was ill, and there was no question of doing anything except just trying to get better. I mean, I'm just glad he's as well as he is, because a lot of people don't recover. But I mean, he's had to take a lot of pills, and, you know, it's changed his whole life.
But he's, in fairness, he's still living, he's socialising. No, but he's doing lots of things, and he's making friends.
He works in horticulture as much as he can. But in the recession, like everybody else, it's not that easy. But he never complains. And if he's offered work, he does it. And he does it to the best of his ability. But because he's on medication, he's limited with some of the machinery and things that he has to use, which is unfortunate, but he has accepted things and he just tries to get on with it.
I ask Richard's mother if Richard's situation and illness is getting easier to handle.
Richard is much better than he was, but that doesn't take away the pain of his illness and wondering, especially after his dad died, how I was going to cope.
If we all accept that life is hard, it almost makes it easier to bear the cross of the illness.
No, I wouldn't agree with that. Richard, you know, it was all based on the fact that he had taken a marijuana, or whatever you call it, marijuana. It's known as the three pulls. His friends all tease him about it. He had taken marijuana and he thought he'd damaged his brain, and this became an obsession with him, and that went on for 5, 6, 7, 8 years non-stop, and that was very difficult. I mean, how do you reassure someone who is convinced they've damaged their brain. That was what triggered off his illness. So I don't know how you could think of that as easy. I didn't find it easy, certainly.
I'd imagine somebody should have given you guidance and a little handbook on how to deal with somebody who has a touch of schizophrenia. Here are 6 or 7 useful tips.
Well, I was the kind of person, I didn't enjoy visiting psychiatrists, and I decided that they weren't going to do much for me personally. So maybe the fault lies with me. I didn't get involved in all this group therapy and stuff. I just did the best I could on my own. And, I mean, Richard has improved enormously. In fact, he's 98% well. But sadly, because he has a history of illness, then people kind of look at him a second time. But he's much, much better than he was. And for that, I'm very grateful.
One way Richard's mother tried to deal with the pain was through sport.
Well, I always liked playing tennis. And after Dan died, that was my one outlet. I used to go and play tennis. And I suppose that was my exercise. And I had friends who were supportive and that, you know. But it still didn't take away the pain.
You couldn't even bring yourself to stay.
We're going to pause this particular narration and talk about a place called Burton Hall. Burton Hall is part of the Clún Mhíre service, which is a community-based adult mental health service serving a population of over 175,000 in the Dublin southeast area. Burton Hall itself, which is located in Sandyford, provides, among other services, training, rehabilitation, and most importantly, a sense of community and belonging for the service users. I went out to Burton Hall to meet Richard. One of the main activities Richard performs in Burton Hall is horticulture and gardening. Richard, where are we now?
We're now on the south border, the south and west border. It's an old Victorian garden that was founded in the late 1880s or 90s, as far as I know. We can check that with Eric, but it's an old garden, and it was owned by the brothers, the John of God brothers. And before that, some wealthy family lived here in the house, and there were stables and horses, and it was a kind of an Edwardian residence. Gardening is a very therapeutic thing for people who've had psychiatric illness or mental health difficulties, because even though you could be busy, it's relaxing, and it's pressurised in a way, but not in the same way as a factory job would be, or an office job or something like that. So it's a great outlet for people who've suffered.
Richard tries hard to pick up part-time work and does succeed in picking up part-time work, but he now talks about shadow working. This is a job.
This is a job, and if things improved in the next couple of years, it'd be fantastic if a few people who are like Liz and myself, who are fairly recovered from our problems, to be able to, you know, get out. Some people would like anyway to go and shadow a job. The Job Shadow Initiative is where a person with a disability goes into a job and gets paid about 35 or 40 euros a day on top of their disability, and does the job of a person in a company, and is shown the job, and then shadows the person in the job and does the job of that person maybe 2 days a week if that person is on job sharing. And if the person's on job sharing, it would be great that if some people, it would give them back their dignity if they had a couple of days a week work. We're lucky here in Burton Hall that we have here to come to, but not everybody who has a problem, who has a psychological difficulty, has somewhere to go or somewhere to come to every day. And that's particularly distressing for a lot of them, because it's purpose in life. And as Liz said, the therapeutic effect of coming here and relaxing and enjoying the work and spending the day here, and the way Liz said she loves it and doesn't want doesn't like leaving. That's fantastic. It means that, you know, you've got a purpose each week and every day, and it's important to have the structure, and that's what we need.
Richard briefly touches on how hard it is for a mental health service user to participate fully in society.
Just talking about the Mental Health Act of 2001, it talks about equity, accountability, dignity and respect and empowerment for people with mental illness. But to be honest with you, people with mental illness are not empowered at all. They don't have any say as to chances of employment. They're stigmatised by society. They're not given a chance. They have to get by on a disability allowance, and they don't have much money. And it's very difficult for sufferers to get back into the, you know, mainstream of society, vis-a-vis work, etc., etc. But the thing is, at the moment, with things being so bad, a lot of people aren't working, but sufferers don't have a chance of getting any work.
If I said to you, oh, do you have a disability, does that word bother you?
Not really, because it's not a physical disability, but it is, to a degree, a disability. You can't do things, you can't work under the same pressure as inverted commas, people with no disability or well people. But there's a lot we can do, and with medication improving and with therapies improving and, you know, being able to talk out your problems, it is improving a lot. And the word doesn't bother me, but on the other hand, I don't want to be classified as someone who's incapable of working, because I am capable of working. And the one thing about the disability we had, even though it's to do with the head, it's not an intellectual disability. People with schizophrenia and depression are not intellectually impaired. They're often very intelligent, and this isn't sometimes realised in society.
I ask Richard's mother if Richard's situation and illness is getting easier to handle.
Richard is much better than he was, but that doesn't take away the pain of his illness and wondering, especially after his dad died, how I was going to cope.
If we all accept that life is hard, it almost makes it easier to bear the cross of the illness.
No, I wouldn't agree with that. Richard, you know, it was all based on the fact that he had taken a marijuana, or whatever you call it, marijuana. It's known as the three pulls. His friends all tease him about it. He had taken marijuana and he thought he'd damaged his brain. And this became an obsession with them. And that went on for 5, 6, 7, 8 years, nonstop. And that was very difficult. I mean, how do you reassure someone who is convinced they've damaged their brain? That was what triggered off his illness. So I don't know how you could think of that as easy. I didn't find it easy, certainly.
I'd imagine somebody should have given you guidance and a little handbook on how to deal with somebody who has a touch of schizophrenia. Here are 6 or 7 useful tips.
Well, I was the kind of person, I didn't enjoy visiting psychiatrists, and I decided that they weren't going to do much for me personally. So maybe the fault lies with me. I didn't get involved in all this group therapy and stuff. I just did the best I could on my own. And Richard has improved enormously. In fact, he's 98% well, but sadly, because he has a history of illness, then people kind of look at him a second time. But he's much, much better than he was, and for that I'm very grateful.
One way Richard's mother tried to deal with the pain was through sport.
Well, I always liked playing tennis, and after Dan died, that was my one outlet. I used to go and play tennis, and I suppose that was my exercise, and I had friends who were supportive and that, you know, but it still didn't take away the pain.
You couldn't even bring yourself to stay. Oh, love, you had to go.
While in Burton Hall, I came across Liz. Liz, I've just seen you with a wheelbarrow.
I'm weeding up in the flower border. I grow flowers up there for cutting so that I can do flower arrangements for the house.
And coming into Burton Hall, how does it feel to be coming in, to have somewhere to go?
It's very important to me. I really get a lot from being here. The people, we're all the same here. We're not judged. I get very low when I'm on my own. So there are lots of people here that would be in a similar situation and are friendly and open. I work in the hort unit specifically, but I'm in and out of the house and I've got to know a lot of people. Just for a few words, quick chat, check how your people ask you how you're doing and, you know, give you a bit of support on the bad days, things like that.
And there's always a lot to be said for having a purpose to each day and wanting to do things that are set out for you to do and a task. There's nothing, you know the way they say, if you want something done, ask a busy person. If you've the whole day idle, you'll achieve even less than if you came up here. You know, even in your evenings doing things, you'll do more after having spent a day here, being productive here. It's good to be productive.
We've met Richard, we've met his mother and Liz. And now we're going to listen to Eric Casey, who is the manager of Burton Hall. Eric, would you like to introduce the work you do?
Well, I'm the manager here out in Burton Hall, which is a rehab and training centre, and it's part of the Clonmara service, which is actually part of St. John of God services in this area. That's around the Blackrock Sandyford area, and we're based in Sandyford here.
Roughly how many people use the services here?
We support about 100 and around the late 147, 150. It goes anything down to about 130 something. Then it goes up to around 160. Bear in mind that the programmes are individually tailored. People come on a voluntary basis. There's no force or coercion. And you would approximately get about the early 80s attending on a daily basis, so 80 something, approximately a little over half. And of those, two thirds would be guys and the other third would be ladies. And of those, the kind of age span, it would be generally, really most of the people would be between the ages of 35 and 55, a handful of people younger and a handful of people older. And we also support people who are over 65 if they're still, if it's appropriate, and if they want to still come, and if it's the best thing for them.
Eric Casey of Burton Hall describes to me how those who attend Burton Hall feel about Burton Hall.
The word, believe it or not, that comes up from time to time, and it's weird, is feeling secure. That many of the people that come here, and it's not a word I'd use myself in my own job, but when you ask them, they come up repeatedly with this idea that they feel comfortable and they feel secure here because they are with people that they trust and they are being, I won't say cared for because that's a bit arrogant, but they are doing things that make them feel good and they feel they have a future. But security would be the biggest thing, feeling secure, which is, it's an unusual thing. And you'd kind of scratch your head and say, well, I mean, if somebody asked me, do you go to work and do you feel, is security the reason? I'd say definitely not, no. So it just goes to show you how people in a situation where they are suffering from an enduring mental illness are plagued by that feeling of insecurity day after day. Like, can you imagine how that must feel?
During my day at Burton Hall, I met the chaplain, Angela Neville Egan, and asked her about her role in the centre.
My name is Angela Neville Egan and I'm a chaplain, and I'm the chaplain in the Clonmara Mental Health Community Service, And as part of my role as chaplain in Clonmara, I'm chaplain here to Burton Hall, which is one of the community day services within the Clonmara service. So every day I would meet members of Burton Hall and interact, and that's part of my role, is meeting people. As chaplain, my role involves meeting people in relation to their beliefs and their faith. I am a Catholic chaplain, but I meet people of different faiths and no faith, so that doesn't really type of be part of our relationship. Everybody is entitled to their own beliefs, and I'm not here trying to convince them otherwise. So as a Catholic chaplain, I would respect the religious beliefs or otherwise that people have. A lot of people have faith in God or higher power or something bigger than themselves. And I suppose my interaction and my connection about with people is actually primarily about that human connection. And then at times people may talk about their faith or belief in God or prayer or whatever it is, which I am, as chaplain, then part of that is maybe an exploration of that. But very much fundamentally, when I meet people, it's from that human connection, that human dimension that we that's part of us all. And of course, Jerry, we're talking about Burton Hall and the community service that it is, but it's also a St. John of God service. And as St. John of God is our patron saint, we live every day with the legacy of St. John of God, which encompasses values of hospitality, respect, compassion, justice, excellence.
Dr. Fearon rejects the idea that your mental condition defines who you are as a person.
Well, it's very important to realise that just because you get a diagnosis, that doesn't define who you are. In the same way as if you were diagnosed as having diabetes, you'd still be yourself, Jer, who happens to have diabetes and takes measures to optimize it. In the same way with mental health disorders, just because you have, whether it's depression or bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, it doesn't necessarily define who you are. Certainly, it may mean you have to make alterations in your lifestyle, take medication the way people with diabetes or other physical health disorders do. But I would argue that it doesn't define you unless you let it define you or wanted to define you.
As people have said to me before about people who suffer with schizophrenia, don't let it define you. It's only 10% of who you are. People with schizophrenia have a personality and a life outside their illness. It's something that happened to them, the way somebody could break a leg or have a car accident, anything like that. It's a disease that isn't seen, but it is not the whole picture, and it is not the whole part of the person who has the condition. They have other facets. Often a lot of them have been in college, a lot of them have worked, but this disease it does impair them a lot in their lives when they get it. But when you recover, you'd like to get on with your life as if somebody, the same way as if somebody has been in hospital with a physical ailment, they recover, they get well and they get on with it. But society views us differently and doesn't take us the same way, doesn't feel the same way about us. We're stigmatised because they feel that, you know, it's part of our personality that we're a bit queer or a bit mad. It's actually just a chemical imbalance, and it's not the whole picture.